So today we will be finishing out Leviticus, and I just want to, I guess, end by saying thank you for going on this journey with me. And I know it's not a book you typically hear, and I hope you have been able to enjoy it as much as I have, but mostly, honestly, I just hope that it has been helpful to you in getting to understand this book that is very strange to us, and when we read it, it's very hard at times to see how it applies, but as we dig into it more and get to understand it better, we just realize the depths of what is there and how it connects and unlocks things throughout the rest of the Bible. And I also wanted to throw out there that, like, I know it might feel like we've been in this sermon series a long time, but we have literally just scratched the surface. I've talked with a couple people that were thinking of studying Leviticus, and then I started this, and they're like, well, I don't know if I should, like, go read other stuff. It's like, there is so much more there. I have done multiple chapters at a time. Last week I did 3 chapters at a time. There's many, many things that I just haven't talked about, or if I've talked about them, it's very brief, given, like, 1% of all the things that you can dig into there. So I know also in light of that, there are probably lots of questions out there that I haven't addressed, or that I haven't addressed in the way that you were hoping I addressed it, or to the length that you were hoping I addressed it. So if you have any questions from this series, please let me know so I can try to have a good prepared answer for you. I know I've been talking to a lot of people after every sermon, so thank you for the continued discussion that we've had every week. I just want to plead with you to let me know any questions. My email is pretty much my name, mstephenson27@gmail. I can give you my phone number, but like, just get a hold of me with questions that you have. I'd love to just continue talking about this book, and it obviously doesn't have to stop at the Q&A either. I've gotten a really big passion for the Pentateuch and for the Old Testament, especially through this study, and the more I spend time in books like this. I also just want to start also with a thank you for Caleb for the sudden fill-in for last week. There was a funeral that came up that Reed and I drove down to Indiana for. So just thank you to Caleb for that. And ironically, actually, it kind of makes the timing work better for this sermon. This sermon was going to be last week, but now it falls on Palm Sunday, which I think is really cool because the theme of it is God's faithfulness. And I think that's a perfect tie-in to the events of this week. So kind of all that stuff out of the way, today we will be looking at chapters 26 and 27. 26 is the conclusion to the Holiness Code. I know we've talked about the Holiness Code a few times. It is chapters 17 through 26. So basically you have like all of the ritual stuff, the first 16 chapters that ends in the Day of Atonement, and then you get to the Holiness Code, which is kind of like, it flips from more of like the ritual purity to more of like the moral purity, but even with that, there's still some ritual stuff in it. But anyway, so basically the last half of the book is the Holiness Code, and 26 is the conclusion to that. 27, if most commentators ever kind of agree that it's more or less, honestly, an appendix, but again, that kind of comes from talking about the Holiness Code. Like, you have to realize that's a block, and then there's another block that comes afterwards, and 27 is the funding of the temple. And I'm actually going to speak about them in reverse order, because 26 also honestly serves as a summary of the entire book, and that's kind of where I want to spend most of our time, is on the themes of 26. So I'm going to address 27 first, talk about some things there, and then we'll get back to 26. So starting with chapter 27, like I mentioned, it basically talks about the funding of the temple, and what you're going to see in it throughout the paragraphs is you're going to see a discussion of special vows, dedications, and tithes. There's one main thing I want to talk about in this chapter and then just kind of give some summary thoughts. The first main thing I want to talk about is what you see in verses 1 through 8. And this is can be summarized, I guess, as far as like some of the dynamics of happening here. Is that there's a discussion that happens here about what's going on with the valuation of purses. And why I bring this up is that this is a section that people sometimes point to as a part of the Bible that like they don't like. It feels sexist. It feels kind of mean in a way, because again, there's this valuation tie that's very unequal. When it talks about men and women, there's a different valuation. When it talks about ages, there's a different valuation. So I want to address that a little bit, because this is one of those areas of the Bible that people kind of poke at. I want us to first notice that if you read these verses, just starting in verse 1, the Lord spoke to Moses saying, "Speak to the people of Israel and say to them, if anyone makes a special vow to the Lord involving the valuation person." So that special vow there, one thing to know is that these are voluntary vows or offerings that are freely given by a man or a woman. Because sometimes what comes up in the discussion is like, well, this is, and you have to read a lot of stuff into this to get there. But some people are like, well, this is like basically men selling women or whatever. It's like, that's actually not what's going on at all. This is basically like a free will offering. And it's, we'll get there in a little bit, but it's like, it's honestly mostly done at the symbolic level. Now it does happen literally, like Hannah literally dedicated Samuel to the temple and he lived there and served there. But oftentimes this was done more at a, like a symbolic level. Like it's like a dedicating yourself. Like, and kind of the stereotypical thing that reminds me of is like you go to a Christian camp and it's like, well, you dedicate your life to Christ. This is actually taking that more literally. Like you go to the temple and you say like you're giving your free will offering of the value of yourself, basically saying I'm dedicating myself to the Lord. And a lot of times what ended up happening is that rather than actually serving at the temple, you actually gave a certain amount of silver that kind of represented that valuation that was there based on how old you were and what gender you were. So it was like a literal and symbolic at the same way of dedicating yourself and your life to God. And that's also why in the rest of the chapter, you see stuff about like dedicating animals, dedicating houses. This is basically a free will offering of dedication. Like, I mean, it's the same thing kind of with a house. It's like my house will be a place where God is worshiped and God is adored. And you, like, you literally go and do that by matching kind of the value of the house that's given. So I want to start with that, and then we'll talk about some of kind of the whys on how that plays out. But first, kind of continuing the valuation of persons discussion. So first, notice that they're voluntary, freely given. Next, if you're going to say it's sexist, you also have to say it's ageist, because the value actually changes with ages too. So you'd have to bring in both discussions if you're going to have a problem with one of them. And then also finally notice that the age brackets align with brackets of service in the tabernacle. Levites started serving in their 20s and ended in their 50s. If you go throughout the Bible, by the way, like throughout specifically the Pentateuch and also even in Kings and Chronicles, you'll notice places where it talks about like, well, temple service is 30 to 50, and then some places it's like 25 to 55, and other places it's 20 to 60. There's some variance there, and I would argue that the point of that, it's actually more like they're loose rules. It's basically like in your 20s, between 20 and 30, you're like, you're grown up enough and matured, and you're strong enough to do a lot of the stuff in the temple you'd be called to do, and then by the time you're in your 50s, you're no longer able to do that, and you're in retirement age. Especially in that culture where the healthcare wasn't obviously what it is today. So it's like there's 20s to 50s is kind of your temple service time. So that's why in the valuation of persons, you have this 20 to 60 bracket, and then one before that and one after that. So all of these brackets are based around temple service. And then also as a side note, why the youngest bracket starts at 1 month is you have to realize that this is a time in world history that has an incredibly high child mortality rate. And honestly, child mortality levels are high throughout history until far more recently than we'd like to think. But especially at this time, it was a very high probability. So they started at 1 month because at 1 month, the child was deemed likely to survive. And any time before that, they weren't sure based on how high the mortality rate was that like whether or not the child was going to make it. So you waited till 1 month old to dedicate the child. So in light of the temple service, brackets especially, the differences seen in the valuations of different ages or genders reflect productive capacity for tabernacle service, with women having a lower value due not to a lower view of women, but due to cultural and ritual limitations of the duties they could perform. Because basically the value is matching what value you would give to the tabernacle if you actually stayed there. And because men had the ability to perform more functions culturally and ritually, they gave a higher value to the tabernacle. So it's actually not saying anything directly about the like view of men and women. It's just saying like here in the tabernacle, there are only so many things that as a woman you can do, and as a man you can do more, so therefore the value is different. It's not, you can't extrapolate that out to culturally speaking, we demean women. Like that's a big logical jump is what I'm getting at. So I just wanted to point out a couple clarifications with that. And then I also want to give some summary thoughts about the chapter here. One of the main things to realize with this chapter is that this all has to do, again, with funding of the tabernacle. These vows, gifts, and tithes resulted in the tabernacle having the silver and livestock that the Levites needed, because serving the tabernacle was their job. They didn't actually have a source of income, and they weren't like farmers by trade. They were tabernacle service people by trade. So they didn't really have a source of animals, and if their animal source didn't keep getting replenished, like, you're going to sacrifice them all eventually, or they won't be fit for sacrifice. So there needed to be a way to sustain the system. And that's what a lot of these tithes and free will offerings do, is they sustain the system. And because of that, it actually, like, the tabernacle was totally fine either way, whether or not you actually gave the tabernacle, your livestock, or whatever it was you were offering, or you just gave silver, because both of them were helpful to the tabernacle. So they're like, there was really no cultural expectation. In fact, it was totally fine for the tabernacle if you wanted to redeem it. Because when you read this chapter, there's all these caveats about, like, well, if you redeem it, you add 20%. And, like, you can read that and walk away with, like, well, you weren't supposed to redeem it. Actually, like, the tabernacle was totally fine with that, because they got 120% for value of the thing you were dedicating. And a lot of times the point was actually you basically giving an offering to the tabernacle. Like, it's this whole chapter, the best way to think about it is similar to that basket back there. It's the tithes and free will offerings. Like, I know in our New Testament era, kind of we think of the tithes like you generally give 10% to the church or whatever you're able to give. And then free will offerings, anything above that. It's like, essentially, that's what's going on here, is you have your general tithes that are talked about at the end, and then the free will offerings is like a special dedication or a special free will offering that is over and above. And that sustains the tabernacle and the priests. So that's really what's going on in this chapter. It's kind of like a very simple way of summarizing it all. And then notice also that there are built-in ways to prevent people from scamming the system and trying to appear more righteous than they are. There are multiple verses about not being able to make substitutions and not being able to dedicate something that is already dedicated by default, such as the firstborn. And what I mean by that is, if you kind of look at the verses, you'll notice all these words about, like, you can't substitute this animal for this animal. And what's going on there is it's preventing people from appearing righteous and satisfying their own vanity. Because what they could do is, like, well, I'm dedicating X number of livestock, but really what I've done is actually give all my worst livestock to the tabernacle, which I didn't really want them anyway. They weren't that useful to me. So it prevents them from doing that. Because what they could do if they didn't have this rule here is they could, like, walk in with the good-looking ones and then swap them and give the tabernacle the bad ones. So it's preventing something like that. It's also preventing you from saying, like, well, I'm going to dedicate the value of this thing. Well, like, if it's your firstborn, like, the livestock, or if it's your tithe, or it's like every 10th thing, like, that's already dedicated. So, like, what are you doing showing up there saying you're dedicating that when, like, that's already God's? So it's preventing kind of some ways that the system could be abused. And honestly, these caveats remind me of Ananias and Sapphira in the New Testament, where they were trying to scam the system and look more righteous than they were. And what they did is they did, again, in New Testament, in a context of voluntary offerings. People in the new church at the time had decided that as a group, they were going to, some of them, sell their land and then give a portion of that proceeds or all of that proceeds to the church. And what Ananias and Sapphira did is they, again, voluntarily, they didn't have to do anything. They sold their land and then they gave a portion to the church, but said they were giving all. So again, they were trying to appear more righteous than they actually were. It's very similar to the concept here of swapping animals or doing something like that. And we see that they were struck down for that, because that is essentially using the tabernacle, which is supposed to be a place to glorify God, to glorify self, which sounds an awful lot like the reasoning behind the cleansing of the temple. We'll get there. But again, this isn't a thing that goes away in the Old Testament. God is still concerned that offerings brought to him, when you come to his house and glorify him through dedications, through free will offerings, through whatever it is, that ought to be done through a genuine heart, and not a heart that is actually looking to fulfill your own vanity and your own pride through that. And that hasn't changed Old Testament to New Testament. That's still the same. Hence the story of Ananias and Sapphira. So in this chapter, again, to kind of summarize why they can't do substitutes, is you can't make a self-beneficial substitute or lie about one's offering, because this turns an act of love for God and gratitude to him into an act of vanity and love for self. So those are kind of just summary thoughts about chapter 7. And then I want to get back into chapter 26. So we're going to go backwards. In 26, you have What's probably a fairly familiar section because it happens again in Deuteronomy. Like, I feel like when we think of the covenant, think of the law, like the blessings and the cursings is kind of one of those stereotypical things that we think about. But I want us to dig into them a little bit and actually see what's going on here. So the first two verses of chapters 26 serve as an introduction and a conclusion. There's honestly a lot of this that goes on in the Bible. Like, a lot of texts are like hinge texts where they like conclude what's coming before and also introduce what's coming afterwards. So it's just kind of a cool literary feature. But verses 1 through 2 function as a conclusion of the holiness code in 17 and 26, and also as an introduction to the blessings and punishments that are given at the very end here in the rest of 26. These verses summarize what came before as basically, don't commit adultery, keep my Sabbaths, and reverence my sanctuary. I want to talk a little bit about why these three things are actually, honestly, a very good summary of everything that's come before. So the first one, idolatry. Again, if you read these first two verses, you shall not make idols for yourselves or erect an image or a pillar, and you shall not set up a figured stone in your land to bow down to it, for I am the Lord your God. You shall keep my Sabbaths and reverence my sanctuary. I am the Lord. So the first one, idolatry here. They aren't supposed to make idols or images or pillars or figured stone. And then I like how that phrase ends with, for I am the Lord your God. Because the whole point of this is any of those things that you're doing, you're seeking another God. And then he ends that prohibition by saying, I am your God. Don't go seeking any other God, just me. I alone am the Lord your God. And this idolatry here explicitly obviously refers to physical idols or pillars or whatever these things are that are being built. But the idea also is very easily extended out to a warning to not do any of the practices of the pagan worship rituals that we've discussed throughout the chapters of this book. So this idolatry, I think, is obviously referring to like physical idols, but I think that you can also easily extend it out to all of the pagan practices that we've been talking about throughout, and how Israelites and honestly the church throughout all of history, we tend to bring things from the culture around us and from, like, there's a lot of syncretism that happens, and we say we're worshiping God, but like we're either also worshiping this or worshiping a little bit of ourselves, or like we tend to mix things in with it. And that's what God is giving a prohibition for right off the bat here, is you don't worship idols, and you also don't bring in any other worship practices that I haven't told you to do. And then the second word, Sabbaths, there refers to all Sabbath observances, and that's why it's plural, which include the weekly Sabbath, but also the yearly festivals and the special days and the Sabbath year and the year of Jubilee. So this Sabbaths word honestly functions as a summary of like the last few chapters that we just talked about 2 weeks ago, all the Sabbath festivals. And these Sabbaths, as we have seen in the past few weeks, include the teachings of worshiping and honoring God and giving thanks to him, but also include practices that purposely teach love, respect, generosity, and compassion to others, which sounds an awful lot like a summary of some of the other chapters that we've talked about. So we've already got quite a bit of the material from most of the book summarized with just these first two words, idolatry and Sabbaths. And then we also see a call to reverence the sanctuary. And this would include the entire ritual system and everything one did in or near the sanctuary. Because basically to reverence the sanctuary means that God is calling the people to worship him and to act in his house the ways that he has called them to, which is also probably another slam against pulling in other pagan rituals into the worship of God. So therefore, in these two brief verses, we see a summary of not just the holiness code, but honestly of the entire book of Leviticus. And that's why I wanted to talk about chapter 26 as we end here in this series. Before we move on to the blessings and to the punishments, I want to give a brief aside about something that I honestly had pointed out to me recently that there was an opportunity to talk about it earlier, but I didn't even know about it at the time. There's another biblical theology connection that's really cool. In 26:1, and you see there again the ban on don't make idols, don't erect images or pillars, or set up a figured stone. Verse 1 commands the people not to make idols or anything that they would bow down to in worship. And we see also in Leviticus and other places that the tabernacle and even the temple later had no image. They only had the Ark of the Covenant inside the Holy of Holies. This would have been extremely strange. Like when the tabernacle was destroyed and the invaders went in and saw, because they were like ransacking the temple at that point. When they went into the inner sanctum, the Holy of Holies, they would have been confused when they got in there. They'd been like, where is your God? Like every temple in every other culture had a god or multiple gods pictured in the temple and honestly all around the temple and like made very prominent. But you get to Israel's temple and there's nothing there. They'd been like really baffled by that. I mean, they like they've been happy because they're stealing all the gold and stuff like that. But like, where's your big image of your God? Like, why are you? What is going on with this? God commanded that there is no image in His house, and we talked a little about earlier about there is a connection. A lot of the texts that talk about don't make images speak also in the same context about honoring others and loving others, and that we are made in the image of God. So there's a legitimate connection there about how God calls for no images made because He has already made imagers. But I also think there's a really cool foreshadowing to the fact that one day, the perfect image of the invisible God will come. So the absence of the image in the temple was actually a foreshadowing of the greatest image who would ever come. So there's a little double meaning there that's really cool. We are told that to see Christ is to see the Father, for in Him the whole fullness of deity dwells bodily. He is the radiance of the glory of God and the exact imprint of His nature. Hidden, therefore, in the prohibition against the images is the promise that God is sending His perfect image. And again, I wanted to show this real quick because the more I dig into Leviticus, the more I dig into the Old Testament in general and see all the connections that are made, the more that I can look forward and think about that road to Emmaus and just think about the vast amount of material that Jesus could have pulled from for all the connections that pointed to Him in the Old Testament. So that's just kind of a free aside about some really cool biblical theology that we see here in these verses. Moving on to the blessings and the punishments. I want to talk about them as a whole a little bit first. The rest of the chapter is devoted to blessings for obedience and punishments for disobedience. This was the standard way to close major legal texts in the culture of the day. But, as always, there are some key differences when it comes to Israel's God and to Israel's text. We see here promises of how God will act, whereas in the texts of other cultures, we see prayers to gods to act that may or may not be fulfilled. In the biblical text, it is written as if these things will happen. There is a certainty here that you don't see in other texts, where when a covenant is made, it's may the God do this, or may this happen to you. But in Israel's text, it's if this happen, if you do this, this will happen. Because we know that God is alive and that He is active. There is no uncertainty there about God's activity in the world. So that's one key difference. And then the texts of the other cultures also have to call on multiple gods to each act in accordance to their area of responsibility in fulfillment of these hopes of either blessing or punishment. Whereas Israel's text, all this falls on one God. And that's also another major difference between Israel's text and the texts of other cultures. Before we begin working through these verses, I also want you to notice just how much shorter the blessing for obedience section is than the punishment for disobedience section. And that's something you see again later in Deuteronomy. The Lord knows our hearts. Just going to leave that there. What we are going to see in these chapters is a brief but beautiful picture of Eden given in response to obedience, and a longer, more detailed account of punishment given in response to disobedience. So the first one I want to look at is the blessings for obedience. And we see this in 3 through 13. It says, if you walk in my statutes and observe my commandments and do them, then I will give you your rains in their season, and the land shall yield its increase, and the trees of the field will yield their fruit. Your threshings shall last till the time of the grape harvest, and the grape harvest will last to the time of the sowing. And you shall eat your bread to the full and dwell in your land securely. I will give you peace in the land, and you shall lie down, and none shall make you afraid. And I will remove harmful beasts from the land, and the sword shall not go through your land. You shall chase your enemies, and they shall fall before you by the sword. 5 of you shall chase 100, and 100 of you shall chase 10,000. And your enemies shall fall before you by the sword. I will turn to you and make you fruitful and multiply you, and will confirm my covenant with you. You shall eat old store long kept, and you shall clear out the old to make way for the new. I will make my dwelling among you, and my soul will not abhor you. And I will walk among you, and I will be your God, and you will be my people. I am the Lord your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt that you should not be their slaves, and I have broken the bars of your yoke and made you walk erect. There is, again, so much Eden imagery that is happening here. And in these first few verses, we see that we see the blessings that will come to the people if they are faithful and if they live in obedience in the land. In verse 9, if we go back there, it serves as a good summary. If you look at verse 9, it says, I will turn to you and make you fruitful and multiply you and will confirm my covenant with you. The priestly blessing says, the Lord bless you and keep you. The Lord make his face to shine upon you and be gracious to you. The Lord lift up his countenance upon you and give you peace. This is exactly what the Lord promises as the blessing for obedience, that he will look upon them with favor and bless them, keep them, and give them peace. This is also exactly the opposite of what we see in the next section. If you look at verse 17, you skip down there, it says, I will set my face against you, and you will be struck down before your enemies. Those who hate you shall rule over you, and you shall flee when none pursues you. So we see the exact opposite. In blessings, we see that God looks upon them with favor, and with the punishments, we see that he looks upon them with disfavor. The goal of the sacrificial system, as we have seen so far, has been largely to gain or preserve acceptance and favor with God on his sacred space. What we see in this chapter of blessing and punishment is that acceptance and favor in the promised land itself is contingent on covenant faithfulness. Let me kind of re-explain that. So all the sacrifices, a great example is the burnt offering sacrifice. What I've argued is that the better way to understand it is the acceptance onto sacred space offering. It is seeking to maintain, to gain, or preserve acceptance. That is why after the priests, a good example of kind of the logistics of this, the priest, after they're consecrated and ordained, and they have the anointing oil on them, the first thing they do is a burnt offering. It's because they have been prepared for sacred space, to serve God on sacred space, and then the first thing they do is ask permission to enter sacred space. It's all about gaining and preserving God's favor. And it's all, and we see that concept extended now to the land itself. That living in covenant faithfulness and living in obedience to him is how they preserve God's favor, how they maintain God's face shining upon them and looking on them with favor by living in covenant faithfulness. We also see, as I mentioned earlier, in this section of blessing, we see a lot of Eden imagery. And I've talked about how Eden is alluded to and pictured many times throughout this book already, in the tabernacle, in the priestly garb, in the menorah, there's so much Eden imagery, even in like how the cherubim are pictured on the veil blocking access to the Holy of Holies and the holy place, just how the cherubim blocked access to the Garden of Eden after Adam and Eve were kicked out. There's so much Eden imagery happening. And in this blessing section, we also see that the promised land, if they are faithful, will essentially become a new Eden. Just as in Eden, the land will easily yield its fruit and produce so much that they have to get rid of the excess from the previous harvest to make room to store the new harvest. The picture that you have in these verses is almost comical. You see people trying to shove out of the way the old stuff, clear off the shelves, because they have everything's piled everywhere. And they're like, we have no room for the new harvest that came in. That is the picture that you have of the result of covenant faithfulness. As in Eden, there will be peace. We're told that the sword will not go through the land. War will not come through the land, and harmful beasts will be driven away. Just as in Eden, there was peace, and there was also not only peace between man and man, but peace between man and animals. As in Eden, God will walk among them and be their God. Even the wording of be fruitful and multiply appears in these verses. I don't think the author could have been much more intentional about Eden imagery here. As a picture of what the promised land will be if they are faithful. And then we get to the end of this section of blessing, and the end of the blessing serves as an ironic segue into the punishment for disobedience. At the end, we read, starting in verse 13, I am the Lord your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt, that you should not be their slaves, and I have broken the bars of your yoke and made you walk erect. The blessings end with reminding the people that God brought them out of slavery, broke their chains, and made them walk erect or walk free, walk unbound. The punishments end with the people in exile, fearful, faint, perishing in the land of their enemies, no doubt also enslaved. This reversal is made even more pointed when you notice that God specifically reminds them that he brought them out of Egypt. And then if you pay attention to the punishment, he uses plague language as he talks to them about the punishments they will receive. Essentially what he is saying is, what I did to Egypt to free you, I will do to you to cause you to be enslaved. In other words, I am going to reverse everything that I just caused to happen. As mentioned before, the blessing of God looking on them with favor is also reversed as God, we see him setting his face against them, visiting them with panic and disease, walking contrary to them, striking them himself in discipline. God's favor, his blessing, his peace is taken away and reversed in very physical language. It's words purposely used to conjure the idea that God is there doing this himself in response to their disobedience. But also, even despite this reversal language, this very graphic plague language, you also see a theme of grace woven through it. In a series of sevenfold punishments, we see that God will bring discipline to his people. Notice, however, that throughout the whole process, God desires them to repent. It is as if after every sevenfold punishment, you almost feel a pause and him waiting to see if they will turn back to him. And then another sevenfold punishment, and then a pause to see if they will turn back. Their continued unfaithfulness and disobedience continues the cycle of discipline until they are finally expelled from the land, which we know from the rest of the Old Testament. We have the story. We know that happened. We know they were expelled from the land. But even after they are exiled, we see a promise that we read in verses 40 to 45. We see a promise of preservation and restoration, even to the people who had caused him to bring punishment and discipline after discipline after discipline for their unfaithfulness. The image that came into my mind as I was reading this is, I can't remember which book it's in, but it's the image of God's presence leaving his temple due to their disobedience. How it says that he was in the Holy of Holies, and then it says he was on the threshold, and then it says he was on the hill waiting for them. And then he finally left, and they were exiled. So you see this slow, this hesitant withdrawal. God is waiting for the people to come to him. So we see that this God who was spurned so continually, even after all that, still promises to preserve and restore them. In verses 40 to 45, we read, "But if they confess their iniquity and the iniquity of their fathers, in their treachery that they committed against me, and also in walking contrary to me, so that I walked contrary to them and brought them into the land of their enemies, if then their uncircumcised heart is humbled and they make amends for their iniquity, then I will remember my covenant with Jacob, and I will remember my covenant with Isaac and with Abraham, and I will remember the land. And the land shall be abandoned by them and enjoy its Sabbaths while it lies desolate without them. And they shall make amends for their iniquity because they spurned my rules and their soul abhorred my statutes. Yet, for all that, when they're in the land of their enemies, I will spurn them. I will not spurn them, neither will I abhor them so as to destroy them utterly and break my covenant with them, for I am the Lord their God. But I will, for their sake, remember the covenant with their forefathers, whom I brought out of the land of Egypt in the sight of the nations, that I might be their God. I am the Lord." In these verses, we read that if the people confess and turn back to God, that he will always remember his covenant with them. Verse 43 clarifies that this isn't without consequence. In verse 43, we read, "But their land shall be abandoned by them, and it will enjoy its Sabbaths while it lies desolate without them. And they shall make amends for their iniquity, because they spurned my rules and their soul abhorred my statutes." Notice that this comes after they have repented. Verse 43 clarifies that the land will still enjoy its Sabbaths and that they will have to make amends for their iniquity. In other words, they will remain in exile for a certain period of time. The people will cry out to God and realize what they have done, and there will still be consequences, but there will be restoration. He will not leave them there forever. Because we read then in verse 44 to 45, yet for all that, when they're in the land of their enemies, I will not spurn them. I will not abhor them. I will not destroy them utterly or break my covenant with them. I am their God. The covenant that God made with Abraham will be fulfilled. Not because of the faithfulness of the people. Not because of the faithfulness of us. But because of the faithfulness of God. He will fulfill his word because he is there. He is our God. And that brings us to our application for today. Today is Palm Sunday. And again, I think it's beautiful that this sermon ended up on today. Because God's faithfulness was dramatically seen and a new covenant started with the events of the week that began on Palm Sunday. This promise of forgiveness, of grace, and restoration. This promise humbly entered Jerusalem on a donkey. Because this promise was a person. This promise fulfiller, he cleansed the temple of those using it as a place of greed and called for it to be a place of prayer. He then healed the blind and the lame. I don't think it is a stretch at all to see in this sequence of events a reference and an allusion to Leviticus 26:41. And I'm going to turn back there briefly. In 26:41, we read, "So that I walked contrary to them and brought them into the land of their enemies, if then their uncircumcised heart is humbled, and they will make amends for the iniquities," to humble the circumcised or the uncircumcised heart. I don't think it's a stretch to say that this cleansing of the temple was supposed to picture a cleansing of uncircumcised hearts. And then after this cleansing, Christ brought healing. Just as there must be purging before there is cleansing and healing, so also the people are called to repent and to cleanse their heart and turn to God. What he is picturing through this is also a fulfillment of what we see in verse 43, where it says, "The land will be abandoned by them and enjoy its Sabbath, and they will have to make amends for their iniquity." We see in this sequence of events also that the exile was ending. I know that seems like a logical leap, so let me show you how I got there. John the Baptist was the voice crying in the wilderness about this coming person, this coming fulfillment of promises. And he talked about the life and the work of Christ using the words, "Prepare the way of the Lord, make his paths straight." We see this in Mark 1:3. This description of John's role is taken from Isaiah 40. The verses immediately prior to it read, "Comfort, comfort my people, says your God. Speak tenderly to Jerusalem and cry to her that her warfare, her hardship is ended. Her iniquity is pardoned. She has received from the Lord's hand double for all her sins." In Leviticus 26:43, we read that the people will be in exile, in hardship, until they have made amends or been pardoned for their iniquity. The same words we see in Isaiah in the call that John the Baptist fulfills, pointing to the person of Christ. We see here a picture of the exile ending. Christ, through his cleansing and healing, was showing that he was beginning the return from exile and that he was the next step in God's restoration of Eden. Later in the Passion Week, he took the Passover meal with his disciples and told them that his blood would be poured out for many for the forgiveness of sins to begin a new covenant. We will commemorate the fulfillment of this promise and what happened on the cross on that day, on Good Friday this week. On then Easter Sunday, he rose in victory over sin and death and in confirmation that God the Father had accepted his sacrifice. The punishment for disobedience had been fully borne and taken in our place. The punishments that we see here had been fully borne by Christ for us. And then on the day of Pentecost, Israelites from every tribe were forgiven, cleansed, and filled with the Holy Spirit. They were given a new circumcision of the heart by the Spirit of God that we see promised in many places. The book of Acts then goes on to describe how this good news, this gospel, spread not only to the entire historic kingdom of David and Solomon, in other words, the promised land, it spread not just to the promised land, but to the ends of the known world. God not only remembered his covenant and brought restoration, cleansing, and forgiveness, he not only remembered it, but he expanded it beyond what the people were expecting. They thought it was just about the land, and he said, no, it's about the world. It's about everybody. To the church, Jews and Gentiles, Paul writes in 2 Corinthians 2:16 that the promise of Leviticus 26:12 is seen when he says, "For we, the church, are the temple of the living God, as God said, I will make my dwelling among them and walk among them, and I will be their God, and they will be my people." We know, however, from the words of Christ and from the book of Revelation, that there is still more to come. We see fulfillments here. But there is still the end of the story. There are even greater fulfillments that are coming. If the first part was greater than we imagined, so much more will the rest of it be. As Peter reminds his readers, we are still in exile. There is still a final return, a final Sabbath rest that we are looking for and that we are waiting for. There is still a final restoration of God's people and of the land. The promises that God had made are being and will be fulfilled. Let's pray. Dear Lord, I thank you for this book. I thank you for the journey that you have brought myself and us all on as we've looked through and dug into this book. I thank you for the riches that you have given us in every single page of your word. I thank you for this week, how we have looked at your covenant faithfulness to us, how you fulfill your word despite the unfaithfulness of your people, and how you call continually and wait continually and continually respond to our repentance, and that you are always there when we turn back to you. I pray that we would continue to do so each day. I pray this in your name. Amen.